Thank you for joining our podcast. We hope that this message will both teach and encourage you. Here's today's message.
All right, let's get started. We got started a couple minutes late. Maybe we can combine it, like start a couple minutes late and leave a couple minutes early. Maybe. Okay. Let's look at Genesis chapter 8. We're going to get into, last week we talked about Dr. Carl Baugh's canopy theory and Dr. Walter Brown's hydroplate theory. And we're going to get into possibly two videos, and we want to look at basically what happened during the flood. Let's look at Genesis chapter 8. But God remembered Noah, and you can see a little trivia here. You can see the name for God right here, Elohim, in the Hebrew. Remember, right to left, going down. Every once in a while, if I pick up something like that, I'll point it out, just so you can say, what is that gobbledygook over to the right? Well, that is a Middle Ages script of Hebrew with vowel pointers, is what that basically is. Very flowing, very beautiful, very calligraphic. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. Now the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed, and the rain had stopped falling from the sky. So we find the flood initiated by the fountains of the deep and the falling from the sky. And according to the hydroplate theory, we saw that graphic several times of the ground being pierced by this 5/8 of a mile thickness of heavy salinized aqueous material. How do you like that one? Heavily salinized aqueous material. Basically, water. That at one time, basically the plates, the tectonic plates, y'all familiar with tectonic plates? Yes. Tectonic plates of the earth basically floated on, and that water begins exploding up as they're broken up, and that water that was beneath, remember God separated the water from above, the waters beneath. This idea of separation and establishment of the firmament on the days of creation. And the water receded steadily from the earth, and at the end of the 150 days, the water had gone down. And on the 17th, so it took how long? How many months?
7 months.
150 days. 30 into 150, 5 months. And on the 17th day of the 7 months, the ark came to rest on the mountains, plural, mountains of Ararat. The waters continued to recede until the 10th month. So that's 3 more months of receding, right? And on the first day of the 10th month, the tops of the mountains became visible. So now it's 3 more months, 7th month, 10th more month. The mountains become visible. And after 40 days, Noah opened a window he had made in the ark and sent out a raven, and it kept flying back and forth until the water had dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove to see if the water had receded from the surface of the ground. But the dove could find nowhere to perch because there was water over all the surface of the earth. So it returned to Noah in the ark, and he reached out his hand and took the dove and brought it back to himself in the ark. And he waited 7 more days and again sent out the dove from the ark. And when the dove returned to him in the evening, there in its beak was a freshly plucked olive leaf. What does that tell you?
Trees.
Some of the trees survived. Okay? It was a freshly plucked olive leaf. Plucked olive leaf. Then Noah knew that the water had receded from the earth. And he waited 7 more days and sent the dove out again, but this time it did not return to him. Why? Found a place to nest. By the first day of the first month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up. So on Noah's birthday, 600, the flood breaks loose, right? So now it's been 1 year and the first day of the first month, so it's been 1 year. The water had dried up from the earth. Excuse me. Noah then removed the covering from the ark and saw that the surface of the ground was dry. by the 27th day of the second month, so it's two more months, the earth was completely dry. Then God said to Noah, come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives, bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number on it. So Noah came out together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives, and all the animals and all the creatures that move along the ground and all the birds, everything that moves on the land, came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord. There's a building of an altar. Wonder where he got that idea. Maybe it predated the flood. Maybe it connects back to, and then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Maybe it has something to do with Adam, then Shem, and on down to Methuselah, Enoch, so on and so forth. I didn't necessarily name them in order, nor did I name everyone in the list. And taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. Is this under Levitical law? Mosaic law? No. There's something in place that Noah is carrying forward. Okay? So the Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart. Now, this is God's assessment. How many of you know that God makes a really good assessment? He can see stuff nobody else can see, right? And he says, every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. That's not politically correct, is it? Now, this is God's assessment. Even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As I have done. How has he done it? With water. Okay. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. As long as the earth endures. Is he promising that the earth will endure forever?
No.
He's simply saying that as long as the earth endures, that this will continue uninterrupted. Okay? And so we finished that eighth chapter. Let's look at the ninth one real quick. And said, and so then God blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. This is the restatement of the first commission of God that occurred in the garden. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. Now, this is the second time. After you've wiped everything out with a flood, okay, and you can start again, you go back to what the original command was. And that is, go, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. Spread out. There's a lot of territory out there. Then he says this. This is interesting, a new thing. The fear and dread of you will fall on all the beasts of the earth and on all the birds in the sky, on every creature that moves along the ground and on all the fish in the sea. They are given into your hands. What does that tell us about how things were before the flood? Animals didn't dread or fear man. And they weren't eaten. Not at least under God's proscripted diet. And so he says, everything that lives and moves about will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. But you must not eat meat that has its lifeblood still in it. And for your lifeblood, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human being. Two, I will demand an accounting for the life of another human being. And whoever sheds human blood, by human shall their blood be shed, for in the image of God has God made mankind. As for you, be fruitful and increase in number, multiply on the earth and increase upon it. Then God said to Noah and to his sons with him, I now establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you. And here's the covenant. With every living creature that was with you, the birds, the livestock, and all the wild animals. We often hear about covenant that God makes with man, right? But this is a covenant that he makes with the livestock and all the wild animals, all those that come out of the ark with you, every living creature on the earth. I establish my covenant with you. Never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again. Did he say there will not be floods on the earth? No, he didn't say that. He says, never again will all life be destroyed by the waters of a flood. Never again will there be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant I am making between me and you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all generations to come. I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. So before the flood, there doesn't seem to have been rainbow. But after the flood, there's a sign. There's a covenant now. What is it? Rainbow. Whenever I bring clouds over the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will remember my covenant between me and you and all living creatures of every kind. Never again will the waters become a flood to destroy all life. Whenever the rainbow appears in the clouds, I will see it and remember the everlasting covenant between God and all living creatures of every kind on the earth. So God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant I have established between me and all life on the earth. The sons of Noah who came out of the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Ham was the father of Canaan, or Canaan. These were the three sons of Noah. And from them came the people who were scattered over the whole earth. So where did all people on the earth come from? Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So you are either, every one of us sitting in this room right now, we're either Semitic or Shemitic, we're Japhetic, or we're Hamitic in our origins. Some of us are only Japhetic. What's that? The Indo-Europeans, the Celts, the Brits, so on, the Germans and Europe, much of Europe, that would be the Japhetic people. Actually, this is strange enough, India. And you know what's amazing? Even the sons of Japheth have people with very dark skin. Why? Genetics. It was contained in Adam. It was contained in Shem, Ham, and Japheth, the possibilities of differentiation. So you have the sons of Japheth. Who are the Semitic people or the descendants of Shem? Jews and Arabs. Okay, it narrows down the Middle East. Many of them are actually a Semitic people, which is very interesting because we talk about anti-Semitism. In its strictest form, anti-Semitism is opposing any racial Semite simply because they're a Semite or Semitic or Shemitic. So, isn't that wild? And then the Hamitic people, now you're getting into anthropology and you're getting into much of Africa. And you're getting even into Asia, and the islands of the sea are largely Hamitic people. How many of you are a mixture of all three? I've got a touch of a North American Indian tribe in me. That makes me Hamitic. And I'm more Pocahontas than Pocahontas, I'm telling you right now. And I've got a lot of German and Scotch because of this. My mom's side was from Scotland. My dad's side was from Germany, and so and some English in there because of the Scots, and so that makes me almost all Japhetic. I'm hoping that because he came out of Germany, that region may have been heavily populated by Jewish people, and so I'm hoping that I've got, just for fun, that I've got some Jewish blood. That would make me Hamitic, Semitic, and Japhetic, but mostly Japhetic, yes.
The
Well, some of that becomes exposed, and we saw a video, was it last week or two or several weeks ago, where he talks about that this is a humanoid. Right. And so they would probably most likely be Hamitic. And in anthropology, there's been a long time. Where did they say that all mankind originated from? What's been the prevailing view in anthropology? Huh? Africa, right? Oh, the first couple, they came from Africa. Well, not so much. They're having to revise that because with genetics and the ability to track it and look at markers, they're going, oops, we're thinking maybe in the mountains of northern Turkey. Wow, maybe around Ararat. Maybe that's where all the civilizations started. Well, according to the Bible, it's expecting us. Now, the Bible is expecting us to believe two things. One is that early in the book of Genesis, that all humanity on the earth before the flood came from Adam and Eve, one couple. Okay? Now, it's asking us to believe that all people on the earth trace their inheritance back to Noah through Shem, Ham, or Japheth, and then trace their lineage back to Adam through those seven generations that happened between Adam and the other side of the flood. Okay? So the Bible is actually laying that out and saying, so you want to know where everybody came from? Well, originally from Adam, but there was a great cataclysm. And then after that, from the area of Ararat, that's where civilization fanned out from. Oh, we got some breaking news. Anyway, so. So, I want to, let's go to, I've got a video back here, and we'll kind of get that out of the way. It's chapter 2 off of the, I think I can, I have to go back there to change the deal real quick, and we'll watch about a 8-minute video. Maybe we can have a little discussion about that, take a break, and then wrap up with Planet 7X. The background of the flood of Noah. Let's watch. Okay, let's start over again. No, we won't do that. And that's perfect timing for me to cough right in the mic. So, any questions, comments before we take a break? Did you ever hear this before? Did you ever see a video like this before? Okay.
It would make sense given the very beginning of the video. Yeah, as I say, if you look at the St. Helens
Basin. Yeah, St. Helens is a scale model of this.
Right. It took 21 days or something like that to just pretty much completely change the St. Helens Basin.
Mm-hmm. Any comments, questions? All minds are clear? Or are you just saying, next, can we go on, Pastor? Can we go on? Can we please go on? Because we want to hear about Planet 7X and how this all works together. So, we're getting to that. You have the canopy theory, the hydroplate theory. The hydroplate theory works perfectly with what that man is saying as a geologist. And he's standing here looking. One other thing before we take a break, he says the strata, right? And you'll notice that they're all in a straight line, parallel roughly to the surface of the earth, okay? Straight line. With no waviness in between, no huge chunks taken out of the other bottom and then dropped in, you just get a pristine, smooth line. And then you get another line. Then you get another line. Well, what influences that? Water. And the sedimentation, and what runs sedimentation? What determines how the layers are laid down? Gravity and mass, the mass of the object, because heavier things settle out quicker than lighter things. And so, it lays down, and then what happens when that sedimentary rock? It was at one time loose dirt that was tightly compacted by the pressure of the weight above it. And that's how you get sedimentary rock. So that's what you're seeing there in that limestone, that shale. What is all of that? That is sedimentary rock, which means it's been laid down by settling out of water. Settling out of water. Okay, so just bear that in mind. We'll take a break, and then we'll take about a five-minute break, and then we'll jump into... Okay, so how many of you came? We did this on a Sunday night. It's been about a year and a half ago, 2 years, and I had Gil Broussard come. Just on a lark, I thought I'd heard him referenced in a couple things. I thought, that is a fascinating theory. I'd like to hear more about that. So I dug around on the internet, and I emailed him, and he gave me a cell number in my email. And so ever since then, every once in a while, I get text messages back and forth with Gilbert Sharp. We talk about different things. And so he's just he worked in petroleum and oil wells and so on and so forth. An amazing artist. He actually does a lot of his artwork, especially the graphic arts that he does in what he does in his presentation. And he actually came by on a Sunday night, and then we hung out and talked for hours at the hotel afterwards and spent some time the next day. And then he went his way because he was driving through from Colorado back to Louisiana. So he's from deep south Louisiana somewhere. Broussard, can you imagine? And you listen to him, you know it. You may hear his voice in just a moment. I think this is a 10-minute, 58-second video, and this is an interesting theory. Now, I'm going to give the background to it. You'll see it here in the video. The idea of Planet 7X is this. That there, and by the way, in astronomy, they are constantly looking. They believe that there are some kind of orbiting bodies out past what used to be a planet, now back to something else, a moon or something, Pluto. But they are seeing influences upon orbits and movements of comets, other planets, so on and so forth. They're seeing some sort of influence, and they're seeing it mathematically, and they're seeing it by telemetry from satellites, and they're trying to figure out what is explaining that. And so you'll hear a couple things. You'll hear the expression Nibiru, okay? You'll hear the planet X, planet 10, okay? And you will hear it from astrophysicists on the West Coast teaching in colleges that are looking, that they believe that there's some kind of influence at the edges of our solar system. Gil Broussard actually got into this study. Somebody challenged him about it, and he went to poke holes and make fun. And he actually defeated some of the things, but he also developed a theory on his own and said, oh my goodness, this is available from data in world astronomy. What's astronomy? It's different than astrology. Simply watching the movement of planets and stars and so on and so forth, the birth and death of stars, so on and so forth, observing this and charting this and making notes on this. Now, there are people who took and interpreted those things as omens. So there's always an offshoot from astronomy that tends to be astrology. And if you'll remember from the very beginning, I talked about the idea that this is his story or this is God's story. And the problem is when you hijack God's Metzorot, his constellations and what he's doing, and you try to tell your own story, you got it out of whack. Pride's at work. There's a problem here. And so Japanese emperors employed astronomers and then employed people who would interpret that according to their fortunes, what was going to happen that year, and so on and so forth. So astronomy always tended to come out of, astrology tended to always come out of astronomy, and the Bible condemns astronomy. But astrology, thank you. That's testing you. But it also declares that the heavens, the mazarot, the constellations and the movements declare the glory of God, and they tell us of his appointed seasons. And every Jewish feast is determined by phases of the moon. Okay? There are certain things that they look for in the heavens in order to know what time it is, what day it is, what season it is, and what they're supposed to be doing. So, for the longest time, we had the Farmer's Almanac, and farmers planted according to the Farmer's Almanac. We even heard a song, Wildfire, by Michael Martin Murphy. It was the dark of the moon she planted. Right? Remember that song? Yeah, it takes me back now, but I won't go any further. So, without any further ado and no more karaoke, let's go with Gil Brissard. I may have to give some narration. Lays out the idea that this appearance of Planet 7X occurs at certain intervals apart, and that there are certain global events that synchronize with that. There was an ancient story told of the Gihon River, which was before the flood in the days of Cain. Then we get to Noah's great flood, and I'm going to pause that. I'm going to pause that right there, okay? And when we get to Noah's great flood, can you see this up here?
Yeah.
Okay. I kind of reproduced it in a horrible way right there. Okay. The idea is that there's this planet that actually swings through our solar system. At way back, that it would do it about 660 years apart. That was its period. The period is like a wave. It's the amount of time between its appearances. And so it's a periodic event, and it swung through our solar system way back at this time. Okay? It swings around the sun very close to the orbit of Mercury and then goes back out. And depending on where Mars and Mercury and Venus, Mars, Venus, and Earth are, because this would be Mars out here, this would be Earth, that would be Venus. So depending on where they are when this comes by, if you're all the way over here, then it doesn't have much influence. But if it's very close, it has great influence. Okay? And so Noah's flood is targeted at around the year 2349 before the Common Era, and you have the rain. But what was the triggering event? You see this right here? This planet brings with it a lot of fragments. Okay? Now, I'm going to jump forward for just a second. In the book of Revelation, we get a picture of judgment. Okay? And it says this, "And I saw an angel take a great mountain, and it was on fire, and it threw it into the Eretz," or into the earth. Okay? And this is an object of judgment. Matthew, do you have you're probably the quickest on the draw there. If you find that reference, I meant to get this and get it up on the board before you got here, and I'm sorry I was not properly prepared. But I was preparing my taxes today. Angel casts the burning mountain or the burning object into the earth. Book of Revelation. Yes, let me go back to that timeline. I was thinking the same thing. Hold that thought just for a moment. I want to get up to the timeline. Hit pause. There we go. Okay. So you have, this is recorded in history, some sort of flood. Enoch is taken. Noah's great flood. They're 668 years apart. Between these events, the Tower of Babel, 364 years apart. Sodom and Gomorrah, 191 years. Okay? Joseph of Egypt, with the movement of the stars, there's a tilting of the earth. then 276 years, the Exodus, and then 55 years, Joshua's long day, then 121 years, Job's troubles, 297 years, King David and King Saul, the earth tilted 28 degrees to the south, okay? And so what he's done is he's gone into history, Chinese guest star, and he's gone into astronomy history and etchings and carvings where they recorded events by what was happening in the sky, and then using Kepler's laws of planetary motion and other mathematics, we can go back and find the exact day when that happened because of this preservation of momentum and so on and so forth. Yes, do you have that verse?
Revelations 8 and 9.
Okay, Revelations 8, 8 and 9. So go ahead and read it.
And the second angel sounded, and as it were, a great mountain burning with fire was cast into the sea, and the third part of the sea became blood, and the third part of the creatures which were in the sea and had life died, and the third part of the ships were destroyed.
Okay, so you get a picture of a burning mountain being thrown into the sea on the earth. And what happens? A third of it turns to blood, and the shipping's destroyed. Okay, so what is that?
Like a meteor.
Huge meteor. So this planet 7X brings along with it this debris. Okay? So on its first pass, this is his theory, okay? Everybody say theory. That's an idea that pieces some things together, and then you work with that to try to disprove it, okay? Or try to prove it, but you have to do some things with math and physics and so on and so forth. And so as it comes by the earth the first time, it's close enough for the small debris to shatter the canopy. Remember talking about the canopy theory? What's interesting to me is that I've known this and have studied this since the late 80s. I've known this and studied this since the late 80s. But this has just come along. Okay? And it gels with astronomy, it gels with physics, and it gels with mathematics. Okay? Yes?
Verse 10 says, the third angel sounded his trumpet, and a great star blazing like a torch fell from the sky.
Mm-hmm. And then go on. Isn't that the one that goes to the pit? Or no?
No, it says, on a third of the rivers and on the springs of the water, and the name of the star is Wormwood.
And the name of the star is Wormwood. Okay, so it's interesting that it points out the Chinese guest star. Okay, they call it the Red Dragon. They call it the Red Dragon. The Indians call it the Red and the Blue Kachina, K-A-C-H-I-N-A. The Plains and Indians in New Mexico, Arizona, and so on and so forth, they hold on to this idea of the blue and the red Kachina do a dance. Okay? This is ancient recorded. And what's it based on? Stuff they've seen in the sky. It's also, they also put in there things that they interpret that, right? But we can't, it's not good because we don't agree with their interpretation to do away with the thing that they saw. They saw something. They were eyewitnesses of something. Then they interpret it. It's like there's times that I come out from my house very early in the morning, very dark outside, very clear sky. And I've told you this before, as I head towards the east, I think there's an AC-130 doing practice takeoffs and landings at the base because there's this huge, bright light, and I could just swear it's coming at me. And then I realize that's Venus. Do you know how much Venus is recorded as a UFO? And people just swear up and down that it moved and followed them? Sure, but what is it? Some of it is an interpretation of something which is observable. So it's not necessarily an That's not to say there's no such thing as unidentified flying objects, but that is to say that very often Venus is confused in people's minds because it's so bright, and they're moving in a car, and it looks like it's following them. I think it's coming on a final turn into the base, just like every AC-130 I see. And it's not. It's Venus, and it's quite a distance away, by the way. So there is this phenomenon of, and right here it talks about the Earth tilting so many degrees, and even a rotation delay in the Earth. Yes. Why? Because this huge object comes close enough that they've realized this. And this is, you can look this up in astronomy. Some of you are just have a hard time getting to sleep tonight, so you can go to astronomy websites. If orbiting bodies or planets come close enough together, because of the polarization of the energy on that planet, they have a tendency to bow towards one another as they come by. And so if this planet 7X comes close enough to the Earth, it actually makes the Earth bow. Now, what's really fascinating, we're jumping way ahead, and we'll come back to it when we get there, if we ever get there. Joseph has a dream, and he talks about the stars bowing to him. The stars bowing. Back at the time of the drought in Egypt, there was, in Joseph's day, there was actually the ability to see more of the southern sky than they'd ever seen. And this event was recorded at an observatory in Germany. It wasn't called Germany then, where they actually engraved all of the landmarks recording this event, along with angles that they used in calculating, and they were listing constellations and stars that they shouldn't have been able to see. And the reason they recorded it was because for a period of time, the Earth shifted to the south, and there were constellations to the north they could not see. They were hidden behind the horizon, but there were stars to the south they could see for the first time. And they knew, man, this is big. Now, jumping way ahead back to the book of Revelation, there's an expression there that it says, I saw the stars falling to the ground. What is that? It could be one of two things. A meteor shower or the tilting of the Earth. Because when it tilts, there's going to be a horizon where you get a blur or a streak of stars towards that horizon. It looks like the stars have just fallen to the ground as you're observing it from the Earth. And so these are just fascinating things that we see in Scripture that we typically go, what are they talking about? Well, let's just skip over that. And so when you get into this theory, it's like, whoa, yeah, wow, you know, it's described there, very possible. So I'll play it onward, and we get to the flood of Noah, and we can look at this, because he does a much better job. He calls it the fiery red dragon of old, and it's also described that way by astronomers, especially Korean and Japanese. Here we go, the great flood. So, very interesting. His proposal is that the speed at which this moves, it passes the Earth and pierces the canopy, right? But on its way back out, the Earth has moved in its orbit, okay? It starts with a meteor storm. And then while the Earth, 150 days later, which is how many months?
Five
months. Scripture talks about 5 months. What happens at the end of the Earth is covered with water. Okay? There is a meteorite that impacts the Earth while it's covered with water, and it knocks it off its axis from the impact. Now, if you look at even evolutionistic theory and Earth history, you will hear about the extinction of the dinosaurs and an impact of a meteorite. Okay? The problem they have is this. The size of that meteorite would be so large that the energy with which it imparts itself to the Earth would then create such heat that everything on the Earth would burn up. This is the problem with that theory, because it would generate such heat and release such problem. So what they do, again, is they put it back in history way, way back, right? Everybody say way, way back. Because when you go with uniformitarianism and evolutionistic theory, you need more time, and you got to put it way back. But this theory is that when this impacts, the Earth is covered with water. Now, what's been going on? Hydroplate theory, right? You have major displacement of Earth over on top of other places. So you had an Earth that was mostly landmass exposed and very little water exposed before the flood, right? And after the flood, you have one-third landmass exposed, two-thirds water. And where did all of that stuff go that's in the mid-oceanic trenches that are miles deep? Did you ever look at the global map? We've seen this probably enough. You just got the idea. And I'm going to go to, how many of you have Google Earth? I mostly like to go there and look at Israel. But a lot of top secret stuff you're not going to be able to see. But, you know, Area 51, it doesn't show any spacecraft going in and out of that. But look here. Look out here. And now, what is Pangea? Everybody know the theory of Pangea? At one time it was all together, then what did it do? It drifted. How about this? Look at this interesting feature between this and this. See that? That's where Dr. Walter Brown talks about when the pressure is let off, this upheaves. It pushes up. And when it pushes up, it then takes the resulting land and pushes it away. But it's also has blown away so much of this by being exploded upward. Okay? Now this will really mess with you. How many of you know that every year in September, we go through a debris field? What's it called? The Leonid Showers. Named for a Russian astronomer, probably. Okay, whoever discovers it gets their name on it, like the Hubble. He discovered some stuff, so he gets the name Hubble Telescope. Some of what was on the Earth, with this powerful burst of water with the fountains of the deep broken up, launched that stuff away from the Earth into space. So it's sitting out there. And what do we do every year? We circle around, right? 365 days it takes us to go from this point in space around the sun and back, right? And when we do, we pass through a debris field every time. Yes. But you have the mass of the Earth, and we know from physics that one mass attracts the other, and the closest object to those pieces is the Earth by an exponential amount. And so with proximity to the Earth, they're going to reach a point at which they're not moving very fast. And then what happens is they're drawn back in, and they crash onto the Earth. And then we go discover a piece of it, right? And we go, Shazam. Look, it's got some water and bacteria in it. Oh my, where did this come from? Hey, how about if it's a piece of our Earth? And it's a momentum, that's a memento that the Earth was struck, and there was this cataclysm of Noah's flood. When we think of the flood, please don't think of gently trickling water and slowly rising tides. We're talking horrendous, massive change, cataclysmic change that wipes out and moves about much of the Earth's surface. And what we see on our own continent is a much of this mass of land upheaved onto our continent to the depths of 4,000 feet. Okay? If you have to go to the basement of the Grand Canyon to get to where that place was before, and now there's 4,000 feet up to the desert floor, and then you go to the north and you go another 4,000 or 5,000 feet up to the next area that was laid down by the flood. But where did that all come from? It was shoved over, it was plates coming over each other, and it was debris that was suspended in the floodwaters that was then deposited elsewhere. Okay? Now, in the middle of all of that, we have a feature. Do you know what is the largest impact meteor crater on the planet, according to astronomers and geologists and people who are into that sort of thing? The Gulf of Mexico. The Gulf of Mexico is the largest impact crater. You thought it was the crater out in Arizona, New Mexico, right? Over by the border there. Nope. There are more places around South America that they believe are actually meteor craters. And they calculated the amount, the size of that. It had to be about 110 miles across. Now, the earth was flooded, but it was gut punched with 110 mile wide. Now, I'm quoting astronomers and geologists. I'm not even quoting young earth geologists and astronomers. I'm talking about not even creation science or Ken Ham or Henry Morris. I'm talking about secular, in the museum, well-funded and underwritten chairs of departments that are talking about this event and this large crater. If the earth was dry, it would have burned up the earth. If the earth was covered with water, then the energy would have been tamped down and the ocean would have absorbed the heat. Or like a big heat sink, because it's everywhere. And it would distribute the energy. Now, what is on the opposite, roughly the opposite side of that feature? Right here, with the tallest mountains in the world, the Himalayas. So you have a punch in the side of the earth, skewing it off of its axis so that it wobbles. How many of you know the earth wobbles? It wobbles. Okay? And on the opposite side, roughly, because of the energy moving through the core, what you have is you have the highest mountains in the world thrust up. And as Dr. Brown says, there's water trapped under those mountains. According to hydroplate theory, he beat them all to the punch. And he said, you will find some anomalies because there are large reservoirs of salt water trapped under those mountains. Wow.
Well, you're also talking
like terra joules. It's just astounding. So the Earth axis was normally like this, but when you move it off axis, that gives you this rotation where we have winter solstice, summer solstice. That tells us the most extreme north, the most extreme south, and then the midpoint between the two is called the equinox. The equinox, autumnal and vernal equinoxes. And this just continues. And the Lord says, as long as the earth is intact, these seasons will happen. Yeah, he knew it would make seasons. And so, just in Noah's event, just in the cataclysm of the flood of Noah, you have explanation for everything geological. Everything geological is explained by an event lasting just over a year from beginning to end. So when you go, how many of you have ever been to, into Colorado? Have you ever been to, what's the name of that? The Gorge up there. Is that the Royal Gorge? Yeah. I was thinking of the name of the town. Did you go up just into Colorado and then you head a little bit west? Oh, we have another update? Okay. Well, the president's still speaking. So you go down the Royal Gorge and you will see rock that is absolutely ribboned and shifted. That doesn't happen over time, folks. That happens when it's still soft. And then there is a geological thrust or a movement from below that bends that, like ribbon candy. How many of you have ever seen ribbon candy? You don't make ribbon candy that way when it's hard. When it's hot and soft, then what do? You bend it, push it together. Then when it sets, there it is, right? And so when we look at these things, if you are a long-time evolutionist, uniformitarian, you see this stuff and you go, wow, look at that rock. It was just all bent up. No, it was layered by sedimentation. And then there was some sort of impact or movement which pushed it. How many of you have ever seen the Appalachians? You go to the East Coast and you have folded mountains. And they're roughly perpendicular to that spot where there's an upshift in the ocean floor. Something shoved them while they were still wet. And then they set. But there's no erosion between the layers. Not 17 billion years or 4 billion years. It has to be laid down like a layer cake while it was still wet, moved, and then set as the wind was come over the earth and it was dried. And then it hardens to rock. You go to Mount St. Helens today and you can walk a canyon that mirrors the Grand Canyon exactly. And if you blindfolded a geologist and took him there and he didn't know where he was, he would come out yammering about, well, we're talking hundreds of millions of years. Where's this at? Where are we at? I got to know. Well, you're standing in a place that 30 years ago was a plush forest and looked nothing like this. Mount St. Helens blew, and all of the geological features that we were convinced through typical geology took hundreds of millions of years, they suddenly were having to take huge sections out of their textbook and put it in the shredder. Out with that idea, it just doesn't work. Because why? It was a cataclysmic event. Blowing out the whole side of a mountain? Cataclysmic event. And it was only a tiny snapshot of the power that happened when the judgment of God was unleashed upon the earth. One final thought, and then we have any questions, and we'll go. Be sure we leave on time, okay? Y'all okay with that? Or you're saying, please, more, Pastor, please. No, I know you're not doing that. It's interesting to me, this is going to be a social commentary right here. It's interesting to me, what is the symbol of the gay pride movement? Rainbow. Rainbow. Now, there's actually a dual meaning to the rainbow covenant as far as God is concerned. As we're talking about the sevenfold spirit of God and the light and the fire of the Holy Spirit, we understand the parallel to the rainbow. By the way, when you take white light, use a prism and divide it up. What into its constituent colors, what do you get? Roy Green Biv. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. That's visible light from the lowest part of the spectrum, or oscillation of photons, which is red, all the way through violet, which is a higher frequency. And your eye and my eye can only see that. But when those are all together, what do they have? It's white light. It's the light that we have. Okay? Now, the rainbow, there's something that happened in the atmosphere. There's something that happened in the judgment of God. And there was something that possibly even happened in the speed of light. And now it was visible in the atmosphere. And it's a reminder of what? As long as the earth endures, I will not destroy it by water. Okay? But it's also letting us know something about the next judgment. Because the next judgment is a judgment of
fire.
Read the book of Revelation. That book is filled with fire. And at the last chapters, it says that Peter says that the elements will pass away with a fervent heat. John says that the heavens and the earth fled away and they were no more. We have to understand that the rainbow covenant is also saying this. I get in trouble being Dougie Downer all the time on this, but here's what God is saying. Never again water. Next time, fire. Next time, it's fire. Okay, so what they're doing is they're literally playing with fire. Isn't it interesting that the enemy, and I'm just going to speak straight to this, the enemy has stolen a covenant of God withholding judgment by water, and they've adopted it as their flag for their pride. Is that hubris or what? Is that hubris or what? And Peter tells us, what's interesting is Peter is fascinated with the flood. Because we hear in Peter that he says that there will be scoffers and they are purposely ignorant of the flood. Purposely ignorant of the flood. Purposely forgetting the flood and its lesson. And what it's his lesson? It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Because he, and what's amazing is we go to the Grand Canyon, we go to the Royal Gorge, we go to these places on the earth, we take pictures and we look at it and go, this is gorgeous. And we often say this, look what God has made. And sometimes if we're not careful, we romanticize it, and we need to say this, really think about this. That's here because of the judgment of God. Look what the judgment of God did. And it's like beautiful scars upon the earth. But every time I go down into the Royal Gorge or I see some of these twisted and bent rocks that were one time sedimentary layer, I go, it's a fearful thing to fall into the hand of the living God. That's a fearful thing. Because he unleashed his judgment on the earth. And it has been totally devastated. And because of his mercy, we have repopulated it. But we're awaiting a judgment by fire. That's the other shoe that's going to drop, folks. I know that's not happy, happy, joy, joy. Oh, wonderful, Pastor. You just pumped us all up and we get to go home with happy thoughts. That needs to be sobering. And we say, whoa, we can't take the day of salvation lightly. We can't take the mercies of God. Do you realize what's happened? We can look every day on our planet at the horrible scars. We can think of the crucifixion and the horrible scars. And we say, Jesus took our punishment. I think I want to take him at his word. I want to follow him. Because he's the only one that can get us out of the fire. That's the only ark that's not going to burn. And his name is Jesus, right?
Yes.
That's a powerful reason for the flood of Noah and why we need to take it very seriously. Any questions before we go? I see 2 minutes back there. Is that clock wrong? Because I've been staring at that clock back there. I have 8:31. Oh, I went one over. And that, look, I want you all turn and look. All turn and look right back there. Right there. I thought I had 2 minutes left. I'm sorry. All right, let's have a word of prayer. And if you want to hang around, ask a few questions or talk a little bit, that's fine. I'm here. If you need to go, Lord bless you. So, Lord, we just bow before you. We really want to take your word seriously. We really want to hear what you're saying. And instead of being a skeptic and a scoffer and say, oh, that can't be what it means. Lord, help us to stop and consider some alternate ideas than just strictly secular science, godless humanism, people who want to avoid the idea of a global cataclysm and your judgment because it speaks of a future coming global cataclysm and a judgment. I thank you, Lord, that we can be ready for that because Jesus has suffered the wrath of God poured out upon him on the cross. We can obtain salvation through him. And we thank you for that, Lord. Help us to not neglect so great a salvation. We ask that in Jesus' name. Amen.